KALW.
Sometimes I'll have random pedestrians just like run up and be like, stop, you're about to touch a car. Or there's like a table here, you know, and they're freaking out.
Today, we meet a woman who teaches blind people how to get around in the world.
I'm just like, don't worry, chill. Like, I'm a pretty chill person, and I think that works well for this job. It's just like, the cane's gonna find it. They're gonna be fine.
Finding our way. Then Beast Crawl co-founder Paul Corman Roberts reflects on his poetry.
There's the point in my evolution as a poet where I am finding my voice, but then there is the point where I'm learning to use my voice for good.
Poetry with purpose. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Imagine that one day you lost your sight, just like that. If you're a person who can see, close your eyes and give this a try. Maybe try and walk to your kitchen or to the bathroom. And if you're a person who is blind or has low vision, you know what this is like. Getting around independently as a blind person means learning a specialized set of skills and new ways to use your senses. For Disability Pride Month, we're bringing back this story from producer Casey Miner's series, The Specialist. She introduces us to someone who helps newly blind people learn how to navigate the world.
One day, in about 30 minutes, my vision just went from normal to dark, like when you stand up too fast and your vision kind of blacks out. It was basically that, but it never came back.
You know, if you woke up tomorrow blind, I would probably be the first person that you would start working with.
I'm Casey Miner, and this is The Specialist.
I'll aim for the tactile mats and then locate a crossing beacon and then just listen for that.
I think you're going to do great.
All right.
Yeah.
Kat Jones and Marco Salsiccia are standing at a streetcar stop in San Francisco about four blocks from one of Marco's favorite lunch spots, Bacon Bacon. I'll just let you guess what they serve. Our objective, for Marco to walk there.
What would you do if you were here working and wanted to go get lunch at Bacon Bacon?
Probably cross a fourth.
All right, let's do fourth.
Yeah.
Marco's 31, tall, bearded, and dressed head to toe in San Jose Sharks gear. He is a super fan of the Bay Area hockey team. He works at the ride-sharing company Lyft as an accessibility specialist, helping them make their app usable for people who are visually impaired or blind, like he is.
So let's have you cross back to the other side of 4th, and we'll do that one more time.
Kat is an orientation and mobility specialist, that's O&M for short, at the Lighthouse for the Blind and Visually Impaired. She trains blind and low vision people on the skills they need to get around independently, working together for as long as it takes.
I think stopping there at the very base of that curb cut helps, not just going for it.
Yeah, well, that looked great. Let's go ahead and start figuring out the route to Bacon Bacon. Sometimes this job feels a little bit like, you know, being a personal trainer or teaching someone how to ride a bike or, you know, dribble basketball. Is just a lot of it is physical repetition until you get that sort of muscle memory in place.
Her job is to help Marco interpret his environment using his other senses, mainly sound and touch. So picture this, the train stop where we're standing is on an island in the middle of the street. There's a pedestrian push button on Marco's right, the kind that makes a noise, vibrates, and tells you when it's time to cross.
Unfortunately, it's all the way on this side, so he has to kind of stand next to it over here if he wants to actually hear it.
But the edge of the curb is way over to his left, and that's where he needs to be to cross the street. So he has to choose. Does he stand where he can hear the signal telling him when his light is green? Or does he head for the edge of the curb, feeling for the bumps on the ground that let him know he's reached it and where drivers can see he's about to cross? How do you decide which one you're going to do?
Well, This will get really loud, and in the time it takes me to get from here to this wall and orient across the street, there's enough time to also for me to listen if there are any cars that just missed it or are coming. Otherwise, I just line up and go for it.
Marco knows this place pretty well, so in this case, he actually does both. The light changes, and we go. This button's easy to hear, but let's say it wasn't. No problem. He'll just listen to the traffic. Interpreting that wall of sound is the first and biggest skill Kat teaches.
I definitely spend a lot of time just standing at a corner with a person, listening to cars, having them point at where they hear, they think the car is going, and then where they think the destination corner is going to be. And then we start practicing the actual crossings themselves, too.
Marco's been practicing these skills for a while now, but every new route is a new challenge. And in the 2 years since he lost his sight, he has never tried to walk to Bacon Bacon by himself.
Ready?
All right.
Okay, let's do it.
Marco walks in front, sweeping his long white cane out in front of him. Kat and I trail a few feet behind.
So he's doing a really good job with his cane. He's going wide enough to cover his body, and he's going fast enough so that it's in time with his feet. And that's what we try to look for. Sometimes people go too narrow or they go too slow, and then that can become dangerous. They end up missing things. And that could lead to potential, like, running into obstacles or missing a drop-off.
We reach the corner, and what I see makes me nervous. First of all, the intersection is huge. There's tons of traffic, and metal streetcar tracks run down the middle.
Three lanes on either side, plus the center two tracks. So this has got to be, you know, 80 to 100 feet, and just barely enough time to make it over.
There's a crowd of kids crossing the road towards Marco, a guy on a scooter coasting obliviously, and a truck idling right in the middle of the crosswalk. Marco's headed straight for him. This is almost comically challenging, but Kat seems totally relaxed and everything goes smoothly. Marco goes around the truck and reaches the opposite sidewalk before the light turns red. Stage one, complete.
That was really good. How'd that go for you?
It's anxiety-inducing, but it worked.
Yeah.
Crossing a street, maybe it seems like a small thing, like 20 seconds of your day you forget about instantly. But I bet you like being able to do it by yourself, and Marco's no different. He'd had vision problems his whole life, starting with cancer that took his left eye when he was a kid. But that didn't stop him from doing things the way a fully sighted person would. If anything, he was an especially visual person, a game lover, movie buff, and professional animator. So on that bizarre afternoon when things started to go dark, he just figured he'd cope. He'd keep himself busy while he waited for his sight to come back.
I remember I got up and I vacuumed, expecting it to come back. I took a shower. It wasn't really coming back. And at that point, I started to panic.
He went to the doctor, who told him that after years of surgeries and infections, his other eye had just given out. What he could see was mostly gray.
And that's just kind of how it stuck.
Is that what you see now?
I would say it's like, imagine a letterboxed movie. So the top and bottom portion of my vision is dark. The central vision is gray. If I'm in a sunny day, I can kind of tell it's sunny. If it's dark and gray, I can kind of tell that. And the very, very bottom portion of my vision has some sight. I can see movement. If I'm at a performance and there's a lot of light and I'm clapping, I can see my hands kind of moving. I can see a white plate on a black table, but I can't use anything of it. It's all very noisy.
So he can see a very little bit, but it doesn't help him get around.
Immediately, I was just trying to figure out how to live independently.
Remember, his response to his vision going dark was to clean his house and take a shower. Before long, he was cooking.
One of the first things I tried was scrambled eggs. I cracked eggs into a mug. I whipped them. I had a skillet on with some butter in it. Walked over to the skillet, poured the egg, completely missed the skillet. It went all over the range, down the stove, on the floor, and I didn't notice. I was pushing it around with a spatula. I could kind of feel some resistance, but it didn't feel like there was enough resistance when the egg solidified So when I poured it onto a plate, I realized, wait a minute, I'm missing a lot. And from that point, I vowed to just, like, things have to be different.
Do you have it pretty well memorized as to where you're going? Do you remember how to get there?
It's a pretty straight shot.
On the route to Bacon Bacon, Marco's got an advantage. He's a visual person, he's got a visual memory, and he's spent a lot of time in this neighborhood. Kat does teach her students to work with GPS and smartphone apps that can help them find their way around new places. But right now, Marco knows where he is.
Unless things have changed, I know we're standing on the corner, the Safeway's right here. There's an angled door that brings us inside the Safeway. Caltrain's right behind us.
We start walking again, staying pretty far behind Marco, maybe half a block. And I ask Kat how she handles the kind of anxiety for him I felt back at that busy intersection. Actually, I want to know if she even has any. She says, no, not really, but other people do.
You know, sometimes I'll have random pedestrians just like run up and be like, stop, you're about to touch a car, or there's like a table here, you know, and they're freaking out. And I'm just like, don't worry, chill. Like, I'm a pretty chill person, and I think that works well for this job. It's just like, you know, like the cane's gonna find it, they're gonna be fine.
Remember, the point of doing this work is that eventually Marco won't need her. And learning to deal with well-meaning sighted people is a skill in and of itself.
Sometimes I actually do lessons where I step pretty far back from my student, so it looks like we're not together. I call those lessons lurking lessons. So I'm lurking behind them, and this gives the pedestrians around a sense that that person is by themselves. And if he looks like he's alone, a lot more people come up, and then the student gets that experience of what it's like to interact with the public.
Pro tip here, if you see a blind person walking down the street, do not run up to them and grab their elbow and start pushing them where you think they want to go. This is a big enough problem that Marco told me there's actually a move he learned to get out of it.
We learn a thing called the Heinz break, where if someone grabs my elbow, I can move my arm up across my body and that disengages their grip. So you can stop it before they push you somewhere and you can just say, no, no, thank you.
So if you see a blind person who seems like they might need help, Marco says just let them know you're there and ask if you can assist them, you know, just like you would anyone else.
Looks like he found some bike racks.
We catch up and find Marco's hit a wall, literally. He's gotten stuck in a corner where a building kind of juts out.
I found your mommy burger.
So what happened right there?
I was hugging the wall too much.
This is something Kat cautions her students against. It's tempting to stay close to the wall while you're walking because you know you're far away from the road. But that means things like driveways and oddly shaped buildings can trip you up.
There's a slight beer in block at the breezeway. But you figured it out. You got yourself out great.
Yeah.
That's the other thing. Like, it's not a big deal if there's like a little mess up. The bigger thing is, can they get themselves out? I care more about that skill than being perfect every single time, because you're never going to be, even the best cane traveler in the world, it's going to have a lot of things happen where they're going to have to problem solve and get themselves out, and that's really what's important.
How do you feel, like, you're kind of giggling right now, like, what, how do you feel when you encounter a situation like that?
It's silly. I used to really take it pretty hard, because I'm coming from being a pretty crazy perfectionist. And so I get pretty, when we started all of this, I was getting really angry with myself when I made a mistake like that. But now it's easier. It's like, okay, it's all jazz. It's all improvisation. I've made a mistake. Let's figure this out. And I can just imagine myself visually what it must look like with me floundering around trying to figure it out. And that's what makes me laugh.
Obstacle conquered, we continue. And after one more street crossing, we've arrived on the same block as Bacon Bacon. Now, things get more subtle.
So let's go ahead and just kind of walk down the sidewalk and see what features we find as we go. So that slight slope up is the entrance to the donut shop right there.
What'd you just say you were gonna do?
Follow my nose.
Got it.
Gotta use every sense I can.
Sometimes that can actually be a huge thing. Like if you pass like a particular location that smells like laundry or baked bread, you know, and it's consistently like that, it can be a decent landmark.
Kat lets Marco know that the restaurant has a sandwich board outside. Might not always be there, but could be helpful.
How's it smell? Oh, there it is. You can smell the bacon.
There we go.
All right, let's go past it so you just know what's right after Bacon Bacon.
Yeah.
We walk a little farther past the edge of the building.
should seem a little bit different. What do you notice?
It's open air.
Yep. So this opens up into the McDonald's parking lot, which is right next to it. Oh, so you know if you get that breeze or that open sound that you've gotten too far.
Okay.
Yeah, pretty easy to find.
Marco now has all the skills and information he needs to get to Bacon Bacon on his own. When he tries again, he most likely won't need to ask anyone for help. But soliciting assistance, as he and Kat call it, is another major skill. It can seem like a paradox, becoming fully independent by learning when to rely on others. Think about riding a new bus a bit too far, or figuring out if you're on the same side of the street as that coffee shop you're trying to find.
And it doesn't mean that they're necessarily fully dependent on other people. It just means that they are able to quickly and swiftly interact with a public member to get a piece of information that otherwise is very challenging for them to access because they don't have that visual component.
The cane is the same way.
Originally, when I had all my low vision problems, I absolutely didn't want to use the cane when I could still sort of see. I don't know if I felt that it was embarrassing, because it calls you out immediately that there's something wrong, especially being so fiercely independent that now you're using this cane was like a marker that you'll always need help.
But at some point, his relationship to his cane changed.
This is now my vision with this cane. This represents all my new skills. This is how I'm gonna have to get around now. It's just like, yep, it's normal. It doesn't bother me anymore because this is what I need to use. And it's like, okay, what's the next step?
We head back towards Marco's office, and after two more crossings, tricky again, the push buttons are either too quiet or non-existent, so Marco needs to use the sound of idling engines to get across. We make it back to the building and into the lobby.
So do you feel like you could go to Bacon Bacon during your lunch break on your own with some amount of confidence? Or at least with a coworker?
Yeah, a coworker, I think, for now, so I can do that reverse route.
Okay, if we did it one more time, you might feel like you could go on your own.
Probably, yeah.
Okay, cool.
Yay.
Yay.
There's a Veterans Administration film from the 1950s advocating for exactly the kind of job Kat does. It shows a blind veteran trying to go about his daily life, but being thwarted at every turn by well-meaning family members. Don't fiddle with the radio or go for a walk, they say. Let us help you.
Charles, you know you can't go out alone. You might get hit by a car. Wait till Dad gets home. He'll take you for a walk.
A specialist like Kat is going to get a person like Marco as far away from that as possible. So many things can be adapted. Marco has season tickets to Sharks hockey games. He uses a radio to hear them. He loves the card game Cards Against Humanity, so he's brailing his own set. And don't think that the former animator has stopped watching movies. There's a special setting on Netflix for audio description.
A rift in the shape of an elongated letter R forms in darkness.
Actors describe what's going on in between bits of dialogue.
Light pours through, then the R solidifies, becoming metallic, reflecting light, Regency.
Yeah, that's another specialist.
That was an excerpt from a story produced by Casey Miner for her series, The Specialist. It first aired in 2016 and was sound designed and mixed by Seth Samuel.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Henat Baba. Twelve years ago, five East Bay writers gathered for a poetry workshop and decided that it wasn't enough. They wanted a poetry festival. That group became the founders of Beast Crawl, Oakland's own entirely free annual literary festival. It's focused on platforming the talent of writers with
deep roots in the East Bay, and it's happening this weekend. So today we're revisiting a conversation with one of the five founding writers, Paul Corman Roberts. Here he is speaking with KALW's Janae Darden about his book, Bone Moon Palace.
You describe your work as, and I love this, emo hippie rants.
Emo hippie rants. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. I'm really heavily influenced by beat writers. Somebody said, come on, you're just another beat writer. Well, okay, maybe the influence. I don't know that any succeeding generation can ever be a beat writer, but I certainly get a lot of my style from Bob Kaufman. Bob Kaufman is the beat writer who I most sort of empathize with and feel their process with. One of my blurbs, Jack Hirschman, refers to the style that I used as Kabbalistic. And he very much considers Bob Kaufman to have been a Kabbalistic. I never made that connection to Kabbalah before. And I'm like, well, how is this like Kabbalah? You know, I don't know how this is like Kabbalah. And Jack was like, well, it means it's received. It's the way you receive it. It's you're like this channel. Like Jack Hirschman described me as like this tuning fork that was just picking up signals from the universe and writing down those signals that I was picking up. And I thought, okay, that makes sense. I think I do write like that. And I'm pretty sure Bob Kaufman wrote like that too.
Bone Moon Palace. Your book, Bone Moon Palace. What is Bone Moon? What is a bone moon?
Bone Moon is the full moon of February. And it means it because it's the full moon in a time when the harvest stores are down and there's not much going on in the crops in the field. It's the moon that most feels like it shines cold instead of shining heat. And that was a contrast I always liked. Like, well, if the sun is responsible for shining heat, then the moon must be responsible for shining cold, which we know isn't true. But it sounds good to a kid. And then the palace part is it's my reference to the ghost ship. The Bone Moon Palace has always been my affectionate nickname for the ghost ship. And the title is about the Bone Moon Palace or the ghost ship is sort of the centerpiece of my book. A lot of the things that have gone really rough and hard in Oakland over the last 5 to 6 years really sort of center around that particular tragedy.
So in the piece, you will always have poetry. The poets and the artists are saving people. How has poetry saved you?
It's what taught me to look with a critical eye at my own circumstances and at the circumstances of others. Poetry is what taught me to understand my privilege, to understand the blessings that I have, and to understand that art is not meant to be just a takedown. Watching people use art as a form of taking down others, as a vehicle for critique, is okay. I don't have a problem with that. I did the work to be better. Poetry showed me that I needed to do the work to become better, to become not just somebody who wanted to be an artist, but become somebody who was an artist or who was really a poet. And I understand now that the work of a poet is to try to build things up. It's not to try to take everything down or destroy everything or leave everything in flames and ashes. There's a little bit of that involved. But if you're going to do that, you also have to build things back up. You have to leave just like they say to the politicians, you got to give them hope. You got to give somebody something sort of positive to hang their hat on. And that is this book that I've written really is like the reflective chronicle of me learning to do that. There's the point in my evolution as a poet where I am finding my voice, but then there is the point where I'm learning to use my voice for good, I guess.
You're definitely part of the fabric of the literary community here in the Bay Area, and you co-founded Beast Crawl, a literary festival. You built like a sub-community within the literary community in the Bay Area. So this literary festival, Beast Crawl, and I know it's been around for a while, where did that come from?
Oh, I make no bones about it. We stole it from Lit Crawl. We stole it from Lit Crawl across the Bay. It all started in the late aughts, early tens, if you will, when we saw that Litquake had had a lot of success with Lit Crawl. It's really important when you're talking about San Francisco literary organizations that realize Litquake is the larger organization and Lit Crawl is a part of Litquake. But Lit Crawl was such a wonderful, you know, give credit where credit's due. Litquake did a wonderful job using Lit Crawl to build a community, to have this event where the entire community comes together and shares in a space. It's a shared space It's shared art. It's shared human interaction. And they have always done such a wonderful job of that. And it also became this sort of big unwieldy thing where they were starting to sponsor similar crawls in other cities, such as Brooklyn, New York, or Austin, Texas. And there, you know, there was a push to say, well, how come we don't have one in Oakland then? And so we decided we would like to have a literary crawl in Oakland. And we went ahead and did that ourselves.
You know, your work, as we talked about earlier, it's direct. It's in your face. And, you know, you really, you know, grasp hard issues and tough issues and make us look at them. Some of the themes in this book are painful. Mm-hmm. But in the intro of your book, former San Francisco poet laureate Kim Shuck says that most of the pieces are love poems. So what do you say to that?
It's a really appealing idea. Yeah, I know the quote real well. It's one of those things that grabs you. And it's one of those questions or one of those statements that somebody might say at a bar when people are drunk and it could start a fight. But I think the premise of it is true. I think poetry comes from a place of love. I think that's the premise. Poetry comes from a place of love. Therefore, you cannot write a poem that is not from a place of love. If it's not from a place of love, then it is not a poem. I can't explain it any better than that.
That was poet and Beast Crawl co-founder Paul Corman Roberts speaking with KELW's Janae Darden. Paul's book is titled Bone Moon Palace. And Beast Crawl begins this Saturday and will be held in a number of East Bay literary venues. We'll have a link to their schedule at kelw.org/crosscurrents. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.